Next Step, episode 650, November 19th, 2020.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into the Next Step with Father Vodskin. We are the voice of Armadoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. In these weekly episodes, you will find that Father Vodskin's messages are timely, thought-provoking, and based on the solid principles of Christ's love, faith, and hope. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
It's really difficult. I mean, it's more difficult than you might think. It's outright hard to do this. You would think that talking about peace might be difficult. Like, how do you measure peace when we don't know it? But you can talk about peace, right? Because, well, in science and nature, you have situations. I mean, the entire discussion in physics of entropy, right? Liquids, they seek their own equilibrium. Well, what is that equilibrium? It's that state of peace. We're born into this world. Yes, crying, we come in. But essentially, that soul is at peace. And then we clutter it up with all kinds of stuff so that throughout life we have to deal with this non-peace, the reality of non-peace. So we can talk about peace fairly easy because we have different scenarios in our lives that we can bring in examples. We can talk about hatred fairly easily as well. Well, obviously, look around you in the world. We have so many cases where hatred is sticking its ugly head up. So you could point to that, you could point to this, and you could talk about it. But what I'm talking about is the difficulty in talking about an act of hatred without promoting more hatred. How's that? That's the difficulty. That was the challenge that we had some 5 years ago when it was the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Artist Greg Baylarian and myself, we went on a 100-year journey. That's what we called it. And those of you who've been longtime listeners remember this. And it was a very special, special time of our lives to be alive on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. And we put together this presentation. We actually went back to the ancient lands and we walked through those villages. We walked and we saw the other side of Mount Ararat. We went to the ancestral homeland and in a sense returned the DNA. Yeah. 100 years my DNA had not been on that land. And we went back there and our DNA was there. So when we got back to America, here was the challenge for us. We constructed a portal. And if you don't remember it, I definitely have a link on today's show notes. It's been archived on the web. We created a portal in which you walked through. And you walked and you came in touch with the 100-year journey. If you remember, we had some wool that was left over from a shepherd. 100 years later, we actually took that wool, we dyed it, we made it into a beautiful rug. Incredible, incredible. I won't go into the details of it, but I do want to talk about the challenge that we were up against, because it's a challenge that we have today. How do you talk about the Armenian Genocide without promoting more hatred? And this was a challenge that we had, especially with the young kids, because we went from school to school to school, which is fairly easy to do, finding large concentration of Armenians inside of schools here in the Southern California area. And we would talk to the student body and we'd talk about the Armenian Genocide without making sure that we wouldn't promote any more hatred. Like, in other words, it's easy to talk about the Armenian Genocide. The Turks are awful people. They did this and they killed us. And because of that, we are upset with the Turks. But can you have that conversation without, I guess, defining a bad guy to the point where you would naturally promote feelings of ill will at the very least, hatred at the most, right? And let it fester. And that's what's happened within the Armenian community. This is festered. That's the problem. And so it was a challenge for us. And I don't know if we ever reached that challenge. I know along the way we had some really, really difficult time with the young people. But that was the challenge that was before us. It seems like it's the challenge that we have today. So when the Artsakh war began, I was in conversation with Greg. And we were talking about the same thing. Like, okay, there's a war. We're just sitting there and all of a sudden someone has invited us to a war by picking on us, by bombing us and saying, okay, get up. What are you going to do now? Are you going to defend yourself? So what do you do in this case? Because we do promote this idea of peace, but now you are forced to pick up the weapon. Jesus says, he who lives by the sword shall die by the sword. Now, a lot of times people think that that's like some kind of a threat to us, right? No, it's just an axiom. That's all it is. It's an axiom. That's what Jesus throws out at us. If you're going to live by it, you're going to die by this sword. Makes sense, right? It doesn't say don't do that. He tells Peter in a specific moment in the passion narrative, don't put down your sword. But it's not about don't fight. It's about this has to be played out. This specific narrative has to be played out. In our case, okay, what do you do? If you put down the sword, it's an existential threat against you. You put down the sword and you're finished. So you all of a sudden have to come to this moment where you have to defend yourself. And, you know, Augustine does a great job of talking about the just wars. And these are all ways of defining ourselves, of rationalizing things that are irrational. We want to be people of peace. We want to be people who promote love. And all of a sudden you find yourself sitting there, whether it's with a sword, with a gun, or with a bomb, and trying to blow the other guy up. Another creation of God, you're trying to put an end to their existence. And you realize that all of a sudden, if you didn't do that, it would be an end to your existence. But even greater in our case was it's not only an end to my personal existence, but the end to the existence of Armenians in their ancestral homeland. And it's a done deal. So you realize that quite quickly that you have to do something. And so Greg and I were discussing this, like, we don't want to get into this point about justifying it or rationalizing and stretching. And he said, you know, there is a Bodhisattva prayer for humanity. And he said, let me look it up. And he came back to me, can't remember, the same day, next day, but he shared this with me, and I told you at that time that I wanted to share it with you. Bodhisattva, yes, I'm sorry. Bodhisattva, this is in from Mahayana Buddhism. It's a person who's reached nirvana. That's the place where you want to be, okay? Through your meditations, through your life, your life experiences, what you go through and everything. You reach that point of nirvana, but a bodhisattva delays doing so, reaching that point, out of compassion for others. You know, this is really cool because we've talked about it a lot of times, right? And I've shared with you this entire idea of the bodhisattva in the Christian context. Like, it's not enough to just sit there and say, hey, I made it to heaven, I'm going to heaven. You know, I love Jesus Christ, I'm going to heaven. And too bad for you have to suffer here. It doesn't make sense. It's that passion. You have to have compassion for others. The bodhisattva attained nirvana, but holds back out of compassion for others. So here's a bodhisattva prayer for humanity. He goes, and I thank all of those. I know I promised this to you a couple weeks ago. I thank you for reminding me, especially after last week. Goes like this. He goes, may I be a guard for those who need protection, a guide for those on the path, a boat, a raft, a bridge for those who wish to cross the flood. May I be a lamp in the darkness, a resting place for the weary, a healing medicine for all those who are sick, a vase of plenty, a tree of miracles. And for the boundless multitudes of living beings, may I bring sustenance and awakening, enduring like the earth and sky, until all beings are freed from sorrow and all are awakened. And I listened to it. It was a beautiful prayer, but what's the thing that really hit, what's the part that really hit me is the first line. May I be a guard for those who need protection. There it is, the first line. At some point, you need to stand up and be a guard because there are people who need protection. I mean, do you ever think about it in the New Testament when you read, whether it's Jesus or the apostle, they're always caring about what? Who? Widows and orphans. Why? Because they're the ones who need protection. A woman at that time was property. Okay, so if your husband died, you were out on your own. You were just out on the street. If you had a kid, imagine the double whammy, okay? Your husband dies and you have a kid or something, you're just out because you have no property. You have no rights. You're just out there. And this is why Jesus and of the Apostle Paul, the original people who cared about these people, who cared and had compassion. This is why the widows always keep coming up. The orphans coming up, people who need protection. And there it is, the Bodhisattva prayer for humanity. May I be a guard for those who need protection. And I think it's important that as much as we talk about this war that has taken place and has now left upward of 100,000 people without homes, and we have switched gears now to get into humanitarian efforts to bring peace to the souls of not only them, I mean to peace to our souls, because our souls are going through so much difficulty in thinking about them and thinking of ways of how to help, how to reach out to the people in Artsakh, in Armenia. And this is nothing new for us in Inner Shoes Ministries, right? The only difference is that now it happens to people who resemble me a little closer. We share genetically some components of our DNA, kind of like matches. Perhaps yours too, if you're Armenian, right? Yeah. So all of a sudden we tune up. But for us in his shoes, I mean, we've been out there in Africa. We've been there in the Congo, in Darfur. We've been in Rwanda. We've been out there in Thailand. We've been out there in Indonesia through some horrific experiences of people, that what they've gone through, of not only man's inhumanity, but nature's inhumanity towards people, and trying to walk in the shoes of others. And here we are. The war has ended. They've taken away valuable land, landmarks, testaments to our faith. But most importantly, they've taken away life. And they got away with it. They got away with it. And we're trying to put it all together. We are now trying to pick up the pieces, trying to figure out what this is. And it's been amazing to see the number of analyses, the different people who are trying to analyze this. Just remarkable. We should have done that. You know, the Armenia Fund is this. You know that there's people. And then how about this one? Well, you know what? This is exactly what I told you was going to happen. You know, it's interesting because like 2 years ago, Time Magazine like focuses in on Armenia, the Velvet Revolution. Well, last year we go there and we see people thriving under the new regime, under the new parliament, and the war happens. And oh yeah, you know, I told you this wouldn't work. I told you, come on. You know, there's an expression. Analysis is paralysis. I felt that. I think this week, really, I saw so much analysis, over-analysis, to the point where people are paralyzed. And you can't live like that. You cannot live like that. And so we're going full speed ahead in humanitarian efforts. I'm very proud and honored that our diocese has immediately switched into humanitarian aid, because you can analyze it ad nauseum, but it doesn't change the situation that there are people who need food, there are people who need medicine, and people who need shelter. Shelter, food, and medicine. That's it. That's humanitarian aid. And so imagine that we have an opportunity today to be at the end of a genocide. I'm going to use that expression, although, yes, obviously it wasn't a genocide. But the intention is there. And I think we do need to highlight that. I know. Yes, I know. It doesn't fit in. You're right. But I'm going to claim editorial privilege at this point. And just refer to it as a genocide. Part two, okay? 105 years later. And as much as we analyze, as much as we talk about it, it will paralyze us to the point where we don't move ahead. And the only way to move ahead is, first of all, acknowledge what has happened so that we can start addressing these issues. Addressing him by finding food, medicine, and shelter. So that's what we're doing. And, you know, there's a lot of beautiful people that have just risen to the occasion, that have come without looking for any recognition. But I've been, you know, we're at the Burbank, in Burbank, which is just outside of Los Angeles, right next to Glendale. Huge, huge, huge Armenian population. I mean, it's a beehive of activity. You see day and night people bringing in supplies and donating. I had a call just the other day. Somebody said, I've got 100 brand new jackets. Can you get it to Armenia? Yeah, of course we can. Let's do it, you know. And young people selling and raising money. People doing stuff. And that should make us feel very good that, you know, there's this awareness for goodness and to help and to have compassion. What should bother many of us is that it's not consistent. I mean, the help is not consistent. It's not everybody. And you know what? Let me qualify that. You know what bothers me is this general apathy. And you're free to support whatever you want. You're free to turn your head on whatever you want. I firmly believe in that freeness, and that's fine. But then don't come around and sell yourself as something you're not. I mean, you know, Armenians have a few buzz catchphrases that they love. One of them is the first Christian nation. I mean, there's no connection to Christ. There's no connection to the gospel, no connection to Christ's holy church. But we are the first Christian nation. Yeah, this is great, you know. Okay, that's fine, you know. You want to claim that. Now is a time where you need to be able to put up or shut up, right? So if you don't put up, you need to shut up. It's it. That's over, okay? Don't get up and claim anything, because here is your opportunity. It's like you're walking through Jerusalem and all of a sudden this man is carrying a cross and they're sending him up to Golgotha, and you're at that moment, you're watching him come by and you're seeing him just sweat away, and the Roman centurions are like whipping him, and the Jews are walking by and mocking him. And you are there. You are at that moment. Now, they come up to you and say, hey, will you help take this cross a few feet up? Yeah, you're free to do that. For those of you who are a little astute and know what I'm talking about is Simon the Cyrene. He's remembered in one of the Gospels as this person that they stop and they ask him to help carry the cross of Christ. Okay, you're at that moment. You're at that moment of reality, okay? Help Jesus take the cross a little bit. Now, if you refuse, that's fine. That's completely up to you. Nobody could blame you. No, I don't want to do that, right? But then you can't, after that, you can't get up and say that, oh yeah, Jesus, he's my man. It's over. That moment passed you by. And this is that moment in history right now. This war took place. It took 45 days. And supposedly they've won, but you and I both know that there is no justice, and so there can't be peace. And therefore, there are no winners at this point. And we all know that. At this moment, if you're not part of this, then just shut up. April 24th comes around. Oh, yeah, yeah, we were the first people. You know, my grandmother, she was in the genocide. Ah, those were great people. They did so much. My grandmother, she started off with, shut up. It's over. April 24th comes around. Oh, yeah, you know, my kids, we went and we walked down Wilshire Boulevard. Don't do that. You can't do it. If you're not there right now, you cannot do any of that stuff. That's the part that bothers me. It really does bother me. Because I know that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to get up and proclaim this shirt-sleeve Arminianism, shirt-sleeve Christianity. I'll wear it on my shirt so people can see who I am. So let me just warn you, you're not going to find favor with me. And my guess is that probably, of all the things that God forgives, the one thing that he doesn't forgive in Scripture. Yeah, this is true. The one thing that he doesn't forgive is that insincerity. I mean, Jesus forgave everybody except what? The man who was a hypocrite, who said one thing and did another thing. Those were the only people he ever picked on. Yeah, go read it. Go read Scripture. The people he picks on are the hypocrites. That's it. And we guess who the hypocrites are? We're all of us. We say one thing and we do another thing. Now here is a profound moment where you have an opportunity to do something that will coordinate with what you believe. So you do it. You take advantage and you do it. And if you don't, then you need to, as the saying goes, sorry, did I take this from a casino, from a gambling hall? Put up or shut up. All of this to get you to this point. I need a break, don't you? We take a break every week by playing a song of the week. Something to give us a few moments to just calm down in this case, but also to reflect on what we've been listening to, put it all together. When I get back, you're in for a treat. I had a very wonderful young man in the studio the other day, in our virtual studio, named Ezras Telalian. He is a man who went to Artsakh, went to Armenia, and just returned for a couple weeks, basically to pack his bags to go back. He's heading back there Monday. I had a chance to sit with him and share some ideas. So right now, let's take a break right now. Here is the song for today. Thank you. Armin Chakmakian doing Hope Rising off of the Caravans album. I had so many choices this time. I wanted to do something based on hope. Hope Rising. I love that. And of course, you can't get much better than Armin Chakmakian. But I had a conversation with a very dear friend of mine in Yerevan. She had left Artsakh at the beginning of the war along with her young daughter. Her husband stayed back to fight on the front, and she's now in Yerevan. And, you know, there was just so much in this conversation that has bothered me ever since we talked. We talked right after the war ended, and she said, my little daughter now runs around and ducks, is scared because, you know, every time an airplane goes by, is it going to drop something on us? Is there going to be a bomb? Is something? I mean, imagine that kind of trauma the rest of her life, this little kid. But what she said to me next was, I think, the hardest thing for me to absorb. I still can't get over it because I know this person. She's such a strong-willed person and a woman of true faith. Faith not the one that you wear on your shirt sleeve, but a faith that's embedded inside of you. And she said, you know, the first time that the Azeris attacked us during the first war, she's talking back in the 90s, we lost our home. She said, this time we lost hope. And the way she said it, it just rolled off of her tongue. That was just so real for that moment. And you think of all the people, all the damage that's done with the homes and the land and the churches, all that is all secondary to the psychological, emotional damage that's been done and has been implanted in people. To live without something as basic as hope. Hope that tomorrow the sun's going to come up. Something as basic as that. Imagine when you lose hope. Hope Rising, the name of that song, to make us ponder that idea and to remind us that of all the things that we do, let's not forget the first duty that we have is to share the gospel message that there is something beyond the cross. There is a resurrection, and that's where you find hope. I'm really excited. With me today is Yezraz Telalian. I've known him for several years. I had the good pleasure of working with him on a few projects. Glad that you're with me today in this virtual studio that we have. Yezraz is a psychologist, is a man who serves the church as a deacon, and at the same time just returned from Artsakh. And has stories. He just did a presentation over at the Eastern Diocese, and we'll definitely have a link on our show notes today so that you can, our listeners can also be apprised of the stories and the comments that he made there. It was a fascinating interview. But first of all, let me welcome you. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Dad Hayesh.
Tell me, you went as a photojournalist to Artsakh. You went as a psychologist.
I went as a human being, but I went primarily as a photojournalist, but also as a psychologist and also as a deacon. I mean, there were multiple identities at work in that decision.
You were sitting in America, comfortable, and all of a sudden, what's the call that took you there?
I'll recount for you a conversation that I had with my father the day that I booked the flight. And I told him, Dad, it was already 2 weeks into the war. It's at the point where I either book a flight or I don't. And he said, well, you got my support, go for it. And he asked how I decided this. And I said, to be honest, it really wasn't a decision. I don't think I made a decision to go. I said, oh, well then, it was more like a calling. And I said, well, if you want to call it that, then fine, if that's what makes it make sense, but just something that I needed to do at the end of the day. It was something that I needed to do.
So 2 weeks into the war, you decide that you need to get up and go to Armenia. You need to go to Artsakh specifically. It was more than Armenia. You went to Artsakh.
Right. And the first week of the war, during that week, I was already starting to think about going. In the second week of the war, somebody I knew died on the front lines. And so that made it a bit more personal for me, as you can imagine. And so by the second week, I was like, this isn't going away anytime soon. And I had some frustrations with the way that the war was being portrayed in the media, as well as I saw this as an opportunity for me to go and do some good work as a psychologist and help with healing and working with refugees.
Okay, so in Artsakh, you got there, and I understand you went also, you had some credentials as a photojournalist. You were assigned by someone from the LA Times, was it?
Well, so Michael Krikorian worked for the LA Times and for the Fresno Bee previously, but he was going on assignment with CivilNet, and so I got my credentials through them as well, and they set us up and with a driver, transportation. I was basically welcomed onto his team as the photographer. They had the driver and a videographer already and the journalist. So it was providential, I would say, that we were on the same flight from LA, having made independent plans. Wow. And gotten in touch with CivilNet independently. It was amazing. A lot of things came together like this.
Okay, so you find yourself in Artsakh right at the heat of the war, 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the war. You're an American. I assume you haven't been in the military. This is your first.
No military service, no combat training.
So first experience and with people, with soldiers, and you're there and boom, right? There's people throwing bombs at you. It's not the old Fedai wars with guns shooting. It's actual drones and bombs. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I have some military vet friends and have know enough about the military culture to have been somewhat prepared for this as much as I could have been as a civilian, I think. But whoever has preparation for actual war. Mm-hmm. My first experience with really the war was hearing the alarm go off that first night that we stayed in Stepanakert. That was when I got nervous. That was when I got nervous. Just getting out of the shower, realizing my friend had tried twice to get me to come down into the shelter and I couldn't hear him because I was in the shower. I get out and I hear the alarm and I get nervous. But until that point, I really wasn't. I really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And even when they were attacking us with artillery and suicide drones, there was a certain peace and calm that I can only say must come from God. Mm.
So they're attacking you with bombs, right? From these suicide drones, and you're feeling peaceful.
Yeah, I'm not worried. I'm not nervous.
You've got to explain that. You've got to explain that more than just I'm feeling that. How could that possibly happen?
It's really, what good would it do for me to be nervous? Mm-hmm. What good would it do for me to be afraid? With my faith and with also having near-death experiences in the past, I understand that, fearing it isn't going to do any good. Mm. And not fearing it might do some good.
But you said that you there was a feeling from God, which brings up, primarily why we're here today. You're on a religious podcast. What is that feeling from God? What is that? What did you feel?
From God for me is peace. Mm. That's the feeling. Mm-hmm. It's peace. It's the peace that only Jesus can give. It's not peace that the world can give. Goodness.
Wow.
But it's peace.
And would you have been in touch with that peace had you not been there? Is it something that is unique to the experience that was there, or is this something that you felt before? Is this something that is you, Ezra's, or is this something that you found there, this peace?
Yeah, I think it's something that I've always dipped my toe into, perhaps. That I've gotten little tastes of in various ways through various experiences at various points in my life. But not like this, not like this. I was talking with one of my Marine friends about the experience I had when we came under fire. And he said, you know, a lot of people do yoga for years to try to get to this, you know, radical acceptance. You know, thinking of their thoughts, you know, approaching their thoughts with magnanimity and all of this. And they do this for years and they never get there. All you really need to do is go to a combat zone. All you really need to do is get close with death and pair that with the love of other human beings around you in the midst of that danger.
Mm-hmm.
What a blessing.
Yeah, and it will. I'm asking because it just doesn't make sense to somebody listening to this. I'm going to say, wait, you went to a war zone to find peace. I mean, that's what you're saying. And then I guess it's akin to the expression, there are no atheists in foxholes, right? Once you're being bombed at, you're getting killed, you definitely immediately awaken to the fact that.
And I would also comment on the notion that not being in a war zone is somehow more peaceful to us, that our souls are actually more peaceful. And I question for myself how much our environment has an impact on what we're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that plenty of people have so much conflict and they're living comfortably, at least physically comfortably, in their homes in America. Doesn't mean that they're peaceful.
Let's talk a little bit about what you discovered over there. I think that the people that you met there, the different characters, this is a war that was forced upon them. Can you share with us some of the experiences, maybe things that stuck out in your experience when you travel along?
Yeah, everybody was in this together, whether it's the diaspora sending money and goods, whether it was people in Armenia, whether people still left in Artsakh, whether you were on the front lines, whether you were behind the lines, everybody was in this together. There was a sense of communality, of common, that was seeped in common purpose that I think we need to remember, particularly now. And everybody had a story. At some point, I think it was the first day we were in Artsakh, I told Michael, you're looking for stories. Everybody is going to have a story. So the difficulty is not finding stories. It's trying to figure out which ones to tell or how to piece them together. We met remarkable individuals like Hovig and Samra, who is himself a Syrian refugee and it was going to stay there until the end, and would give food out to people, anybody who came to his door, whether they were soldiers back from the front lines, whether they were civilians, whether they were military, medical personnel or journalists, it didn't matter. He fed everybody who came to his door. Open and free hospitality during wartime. He's sticking behind to do this. This is his ministry.
Mm-hmm.
People like Barkev Surpazan, who are steeped in the lives of their people as a true shepherd, as a shepherd par excellence, in the shelter with them day and night and praying with them day and night. People like a doctor we met in a village in the Martuni region, coming from LA, leaving his family. You know, they're so many people, the journalists, that's a whole other, the documentary journalists, everybody, there was a way in which the war was a magnet for goodness. There is a way in which this conflict brought out some of the best in us. And by us, I mean humans, because there were people from all over the world there, all over the world, at our communal table, at the same shelter.
Let's talk about that human, as humans. You alluded to this last night in your talk. You talked about the prayer that we have about parerari of charerar, to those who have malice towards us and those who are benevolent towards us, that we pray for them. And you brought up this issue that we have humans. These are humans that are, it's very difficult for us because we do see black and white in cases like this. And we have the enemy for us as Armenians, who's been ingrained in our head that these people are out to get us. And you refer to them as somebody who's there as a human and in our prayer life. How do you deal with that? I mean, you've gone to a place where maybe the role of the military is to dehumanize people so that we can easily shoot at them.
There is certainly that element in the military, and it is necessary. There is the question of its reversibility as well, but there is a specific target in that sense. More overwhelming to me is the hatred that is portrayed on behalf of the Azeri people. And here I'm going to come out with a radical idea that Azeris are human beings too. They've learned to hate. Some of them have learned to hate. Some of them have learned to love. I would say all of them have learned to do both, just like us. Mm-hmm. Just like us. And in that sense, it behooves us not to give in to hate, to stay on the course of love that is the foundation of our faith, and to not love in word or tongues, but in action and in truth, not to say we love our enemies, but to take care of them even when they're captured after a battle.
Yeah.
And that attitude needs to be amongst us all, an attitude of love and compassion and not giving in to hate, even when people are actively trying to kill you. I know it sounds difficult, but there's a grace in what I've experienced, and that's the more difficult it seems like it should be, the easier it actually gets, if we're willing to be open to that grace. I think that's the key. Christian or not, there is no way for us to be able to continue without destroying each other's unless love and forgiveness and humility and these sorts of things become values for everyone.
Okay, let's talk then about this. If this is our value, that's what the cross, that's what the cassock is, a symbol of that value. And one of the pictures that you share is this priest. I believe his name is Father Varaz. Is that right?
Varazdat, yes.
His name is Varazdat?
Varazdat.
Varazdat. Okay, and you have a picture of him in a cassock, and underneath you see camouflage soldier gear, right? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. Tell me about, and tell us a little bit about the story, because I got bits and pieces. He baptized some kids, and most of those kids didn't make it, right?
It was, yeah. So one of his duties and privileges, I would say, was to go to the front lines and baptize soldiers, minister to them. There were several priests that would do this fairly regularly. A few times a week they were doing this. And we had done the interview. I forget what day of the week it was. It all starts to run together. But it was 2 days later, I ran into him again at the church and asked how it went. And he said, well, it was a miracle that we made it back. And miracle is a word that was often repeated by people who made it back from any frontline situation. It was a miracle I made it back, for that matter. And he said they ended up surrounded on a few sides, and we don't know who made it, really. And so it was clear to me that some of the kids that he had just baptized, they, you know, that was, I mean, it's St. Leon. It really is, in some ways, a modern day. He's a modern day St. Leon, and he has his crew. Mm-hmm. Barkis Serpazon has his crew. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what this war was. It was a fight for existence. And had it not been for the heroism of the soldiers, we would have witnessed a complete annihilation of the population of Artsakh. Mm-hmm. If it were not for the time that they bought for so many people to get out and to change the nature of this war. But it was a war for our very existence. And I was thinking about this in the context of, you know, them striking us or trying to strike us, that it was just because we were there. It was just because we were on the field of Martuni in front of the sign. It was just because we were there. And I know the sign is charged in and of itself these days, but our very existence upsets them. Mm-hmm. They would kill us just for being there.
Right.
And that's a hard pill to swallow. That's a hard pill to swallow, that there is that much hatred in the world, that I could have died just because we were there.
And yeah, manifesting itself in such a profound way. That's the hardest way. Yeah. So let's talk about that miracle that you talked about. It's interesting. These people were coming back from the front, and everyone you said had us would refer to that their safety or their salvation as a miracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, because I want to challenge you to explain to me about that word miracle, because it seems like for everyone who went and came back, that's a miracle. What about the ones who didn't come back? What was that?
Right. And so the word in Armenian, of course, that was used is hrashk, that people would use. Hrashker vor yekav, hrashker vor verat Artsakh. You know, and I would say in that they're saying that God saved me, which gets very tricky, as you're pointing out, because, well, then God didn't save my friend.
Right.
God didn't save my brother. God didn't save my father. God didn't. Well, that gets very tricky.
Mm-hmm.
I think underlying it, though, there are two things. One is the chaotic nature of this war in particular, and these battles in particular. From the first soldier I met, you know, you asked me about other people I met, Chuck Holton. We spent some time together in Stepanakert in Doha. And he was talking about how this is it's a war. What was the word he used? It's a cowardly war. Mm. They're fighting from the sky.
Yeah.
So you've got drones raining down on you and Smerj missiles blowing up and with all of the shrapnel being blown after the initial impact, and you hear the drones over you, you hear these motorcycle engine-y sounding things over you. It's chaotic. Mm-hmm. So to say that you got out of that hell, absolutely. It is up to them to say that that's a miracle. I would say, you know, it's not that others didn't experience a miracle and that's why they died. My take on it is that it is a profound expression of gratitude.
I see. That's well put. Yeah, is it, because it is the person who's going to interpret that experience as a miracle, right?
Yeah.
It's also, I think, points to our hopefulness, our wanting to believe in something, as disturbing as the other side is. We want to kind of believe that there is somebody watching over us, somebody caring about us. And at least in my experience with people such as Barkev Serpazon, it's this no questioning attitude that of course God is watching over us. Whereas we have the comfort of arguing that out. Well, if God's watching over me, that means he's not watching over the other guy because the other guy got blown up, you know. And these are philosophical issues that we go through. Whereas when you're on the front line, it's, yeah, of course God's with us. What does it mean?
Yeah. And when you're in the shelter underneath the church because in doing a truncated badarak because you want to consider the safety of the people, God's still watching. Like that. Yeah, of course God's watching over you. You're still able to do this. We give thanks to God just for the very gift of being able to bless him.
Take a break right there and continue this next week, because the next portion of our interview, we start talking about, well, thankfulness, and especially in a year with all kinds of things going on, from pandemics to racial unrest to the politics of not only the U.S. but of the planet, and on top of it, a war. How do we thank God? What is there to thank God for? And that's where we're going to pick it up next week, because it happens to be Thanksgiving week here in the United States. I know so many of you always question me on this, like, what is this Thanksgiving? How come you guys get a day to be thankful? Well, because we're lucky, you know. It's kind of like one of those things. The pilgrims came and they said, thank you, God, that of all things, half of our population is living. Yeah, that's it. And true story. That's what Thanksgiving is all about. During their first winter, they lost half of the population, and yet they gave thanks. Kind of gives new meaning to those, the glass half empty, half full, right? We've been talking about that, and we'll play the rest of this interview next week. It happens to be right on Thanksgiving Day, so you won't want to miss it. Meanwhile, check out today the show notes. There'll be a link to Ezra's presentation at the Eastern Diocese he made a couple nights ago, as well as a link to his photos, photojournalism at its best. Yes, telling stories through photos. And you'll see exactly what that word means by checking out, well, that link and his pictures. Right now, here's Susie to make her announcement, and I'll be back in a couple moments to share with you some closing thoughts.
Susie here again, popping in to say thank you to you, our listeners. We are thankful for your prayers, kind expressions, and donations. You make this podcast possible. Your listenership and support has allowed us to grow and expand our ministry around the globe. We are grateful to be able to touch so many lives and create lasting friendships. At epostle.net, we are determined to bring apostolic evangelism to an electronic world and look forward to your continued support. Thank you and God bless. We now return to this week's Next Step with Father Vazquen.
Thank you, Susie, for that announcement. And thank you to all of our listeners for all of your support, your love, your prayers, cool little messages you send me, your emails. Oh, I love reading them. And I think you've gotten used to not expecting an answer so soon. But you know that I always end up sooner or later, I get back to you. But I appreciate all of your patience as well. Listen, most importantly, I thank you for your prayers. They go a long way. It's a difficult journey. Sometimes we sit there and day in and day out talk about some of the most difficult questions of faith, questions of who we are. And you know, our whole object here is to connect the dots between our faith, between our life today, and connect it from the beginning of eternity to the end of time. In other words, a continuum that is outside of us and we are inside of it. And to be able to connect those dots, it requires us to love, to have compassion, but it also requires us to not discount this beautiful gift that God has given us, the ability to think, the ability to communicate and to share ideas. So thank you. Listen, I want to end today's podcast with a little personal message. I lost a very dear friend, Archbishop Cebu Chuljan. He is the primate of the Gugart Diocese that's in Armenia. I've known him for just about 30 years, the last three decades. I got to know him when I was the priest in Pasadena, and we had a sister city relationship with Vanatsor, Pasadena and Vanatsor. He is the primate of that region, and just such a wonderful guy. I was in charge of the diocesan summer camp at that time, and had a chance to create a sister relationship with the camp in Vanatsor. And this at a time when it was following the Armenian earthquake, 1988. So there were so many kids that were just devastated, not only physically, psychologically, but there was just no room to do anything and to create a camp, a place where kids could go and spread out and put their fears to one side. I mean, that was a dream come true, and Sırpazan was the man to make that happen. Sebu Sırpazan died at a very young age, 61 years old, and he succumbed to COVID. You know, for all those people who refuse to wear masks and tell us that it's make-believe, don't tell that to me today. Don't talk to me about that today. There's nothing make-believe about this horrible disease, which, by the way, today here in the United States, it reached 250,000. That's a quarter of a million people have died because of COVID. So please do everything you can to be safe and to keep others safe. Archbishop Çulcan, he leaves a legacy, a rich, rich legacy. I'll put a link on today's show notes. Do check it out. He is one of the archbishops, one of the heads of our church. For me personally, it was always a joy to see him, whether it was in Armenia or whether here in the States, whenever we'd run into each other, it was truly just a beautiful moment, and I will definitely miss him. We keep him in our prayers as well as his family. That does it for this week. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Make sure you check out the show notes. There'll be links to all kinds of stuff that we covered, we didn't cover. Make sure you check it out. I want to take this opportunity to thank our guest, Ezraz Telalian, and wish him Godspeed and God's blessings on everything he does, on the beautiful work that he does. And we'll look forward to hearing from him. And definitely, like I said, we'll spend a little bit of Thanksgiving with him as well as we continue with the interview. Listen, that does it for us today. On behalf of Susie, our producer, Ken, our technical director, this is Father Voskin inviting you to join us again next week, Thanksgiving, when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print.
The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of vpostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Off by one top limits.